before we're surgeons and before we have ego and before we're anything else, we have to be human. If a patient comes in with a lump or a bump and I'm flummoxed by it, I tell them in front of the trainees, I'm not sure what this is. So saying I don't know is okay to do. But you can't leave it at that. You have to go then and empty the tank to find out. But once you're able to give patients that assurance, and I think once you're able to communicate with people as a human being without an ego, then I think you've won half the battle.
I'm Professor Pat Murray, and it's great to be back hosting the UCD School of Medicine podcast series, MGA Clinical Influencers, now in its sixth season. The MGA plays a vital role in keeping our School of Medicine graduates in touch with fellow alumni across Ireland and around the world. I'm a UCD School of Medicine alumnus from 1988. I was Dean and Head of the School of Medicine at UCD from December 2012 to June 2018. I'm a Professor of Clinical Pharmacology at UCD and a Consultant Physician at the Mater Misericordiae University Hospital in Dublin, as well as Clinical Lead of the UCD Clinical Research Centre. Dr. Tomás O'Neill graduated from UCD Medicine in 2006. After an intern year in Loughlinstown, Dr. O'Neill commenced on basic surgical training and then entered the plastic surgery residency program in Ireland before undertaking burn injury research in the University of Western Australia. He trained in Yorkshire and in Belfast and undertook clinical fellowships in the Australian Craniofacial Unit in Adelaide under Professor David David, and also in the Royal Children's Hospital in Glasgow in cleft lip and palate surgery. He was the sole cleft surgeon in Wales for 4.5 years. He is now a plastic surgery consultant in St. Vincent's University Hospital, where he has worked since returning from the NHS in 2024. Dr. O'Neill is a decorated clinician with several awards, including the Vice Chancellor's International Scholar at Macquarie University in 2017 and the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons Rowan Nix Scholar for Great Britain and Ireland in 2017 also. Hello, Tom, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna start simple. Maybe you can tell us how you became a doctor and how it ended up being in UCD.
I've kind of wanted to do medicine for a very long time before the Leaving Cert. I went to the Institute purposely to try and get into medical school. You can ask yourself why. I had a sister who died from leukemia before I was born, so stories of hospitals and doctors and all of that kind of went around the house quite a bit when I was growing up. My sister had gone into medicine as the first medic in our family. We weren't from a professional background. My mum trained as a nurse, didn't complete her training, but then worked and self-trained as a chiropodist, got registered and did podiatry, basically. My dad left primary school without doing his final tests to go and work on the family farm. And when it was bequeathed to my elder uncle, he had no education and no job and no career. So he went and got an apprenticeship in the ESB and ended up owning his own electrical shop. But I remember there was a cousin of my dad's came to visit us one time when I was very young, probably 4 or 5. And he was the master of obstetrics in Portiuncula. And I just remember, I was too young to really know what that was, but I remember seeing that he had a much bigger, posher car than we did, that his kids were decked out in finery and had all the toys that I wished for and never got. So, and I had known that your job was kind of relative to your income and what you did. So I asked him what he did and he told me that he was a gynecologist. So I didn't have a clue what that meant, but it registered and off I went. And I knew that pediatrics was to do with kids from when my sister had been with the oncology team in Crumlin and all the stories that had come from that. So when Sister Josephine in the senior infants class asked me what I wanted to be and everyone else in the class when we were about 6, I put up my hand, and when everyone else was saying bus driver, firefighter and all the rest of it, I said I wanted to be a pediatric gynecologist. So needless to say, she nearly dropped her duster. I had 2 nuns up at the house the following evening to have a chat with mum and dad. It all got explained away. But yeah, from a very early stage, I've wanted to be a doctor. And I remember seeing a documentary on a cleft mission. I don't know whether it was Operation Smile or one of those, when I was a much older child, and being absolutely captivated by the difference that a surgeon could make in 1.5 to 2 hours to the life of a child who, for example, in India, if you're female and you're born with a cleft, you're not getting married, basically. And if you don't get married, there's no long-term plan for that family. The husband and the wife, the father and the mother, so to speak, have no pension plan, because their pension plan is to go and live with the family that your daughter marries. So if you have a child with a cleft, it doesn't affect them, their prospects. It affects the entire wider family. And I was mesmerized by how an hour and a half of a surgeon's time with a bit of know-how and the opportunity could make such a drastic difference to so many people within that one family. So that really kind of sharpened my spirit to really want to go and drive to get the Leaving Cert, to get into medical school, all with the intention of becoming a cleft surgeon.
So then when you started, you started straight into Belfield, did you?
All of the practical elements were up here in Belfield. So practical, not anatomy, but the kind of biochemistry, dissection of insects and stuff like that that we had to do at the time. That was all done up here in Belfield. But all of my other undergraduate lectures were between here and Earlsford Terrace. So Earlsford Terrace was very much more biochemistry and anatomy. Chemistry, biology and physics was up here. And I think we shared those lectures with physiotherapy and some other health science people. But I rarely made those lectures, unfortunately, which accounts for me failing first year in medicine. I came up from the countryside and saw the bright lights of Dublin and very quickly realised that the stipend I had to live on from home wasn't enough to pay for pints in the student bar, so I needed a job. And the only job I could get was in the cellar of the barge on Charlemont Bridge, which is a late bar that went on till 2:30. So I was running up and down 3 flights of stairs with trays of mixers and buckets of ice and tapping kegs until 2:30 in the morning. And then we started cleanup. So I wasn't hitting my bed until about 4:30, once a couple of staff pints and a free sandwich were kind of dished out. So the chance of me making the 9 o'clock lectures up here was next to none. And I didn't pass, and I didn't pass the repeats. My dad had died when I was 15, so mum was on her own, and she was like, well, I can't afford to send you back for a repeat year, and I'm not convinced that you're going to pass if you don't stop and kind of cop yourself on a bit. So I scheduled to repeat from books, but I decided I needed to be up in Dublin rather than back home. So I got a job then as a barman in Searson's on Baggot Street, but the same cycle was repeating itself. I wasn't studying or anything else. And it was actually a healthcare informatics tutor from Earlsford Terrace that kind of saved my career. Mick Malloy, who was kind of big in the IMO at the time as well, asked a few people where I was. He'd known me from Hospitals Cup rugby training as a first year, and I was nowhere to be seen. He asked a few of the lads from the Vincent's team and UCD medicine, and they told me that I'd failed and I was working as a barman in Searson's but repeating from books. So he got my number and asked me to go and visit him. And I went in and had a chat with him. And he said, look, you're not going to pass if you keep going on doing what you're doing. You're never going to pass these lectures and these exams if you're not studying it. So he said, look, give me a couple of weeks and we'll have another coffee in Earlsford Terrace. So I went back to him a couple of weeks later and he goes, right, I have it fixed. You're going to come and live with me. You're not going to pay any rent, but you're going to drive me to the IMO meetings because I can't drive. Yeah, you're going to get a job as a healthcare assistant in St. Vincent's Hospital and you're going to work on Lawrence's ward, which is orthopedics, but you're going to do nothing but nights. So you do 4 nights 1 week, 3 nights the next week. You're going to buy yourself a laptop and you're going to write yourself lectures to all of the topics that you failed. You're going to study it from the book and you're going to write yourself your own lectures in PowerPoint. And when you get a break on your night shift, you're going to watch your lecture back to yourself. So I did that and I passed. From then I kind of caught myself on, pulled my socks up and kind of progressed through medical school from there.
I didn't know any of that. Mick is, of course, down in Wexford now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's an ED consultant in Wexford.
Did you have to have a meeting with the dean at some stage during all this?
I did. I had to go in and have a talk with the head of anatomy, whose name escapes me, the professor who was down there at the time. I remember the anatomy exam was the morning after the first Hospitals Cup match I'd ever taken part in. And Vincent's lost to the Mater. The guys who were running it had a budget for the year that basically came from the consultant subscriptions from Vincent's Hospital. So we went into the Merrion Inn to spend the remaining annual budget because there was no more matches to be played. At about 2 o'clock the morning of my exam, I stumbled home to the flat on Leeson Street and fell asleep in my number ones, which was navy blazer, blue shirt, cream chinos and the club tie. And I woke 5 minutes after the exam started, you know, literally on Leeson Street. The exam was in Earlsford Terrace, and I was what I thought inappropriate attire. So I just sprinted out the door and down Leeson Street. And the anatomy demo technician was a very kind soul and let me in because they hadn't even given the brief yet. But, yeah, you know, I was 10 minutes late for the exam. So they gave the brief and I sat the anatomy MCQ first. I started trying for the first five or six questions and I realized I didn't even know some of the words that were on the page. So I thought I would take a positive approach and answer true for everything thereafter. But I didn't really read the small print that it was plus one, minus one for negatively marked MCQs. So in the heat of the hunt, I came out with a score of something like 22 or 24%. And at the follow-up appointment with the anatomy professor, he said, you know, if a trained monkey was went in there and hit true for absolutely everything, they would have scored 25%. And you managed to score less than that. That was my introduction to exams in UCD School of Medicine. And there was only really one way to go from there, let's be honest.
But it's interesting that, you know, most people believe that everyone should get a second chance. And it's a good demonstration of that in the end.
I think so. And I naively thought that the big obstacle, you know, my Everest was getting into medical school. Yeah. I thought that once you achieved that, that getting through medical school would be absolutely fine, that I didn't really need to work that hard. But, you know, the opposite was completely the case. But I found even before I went into hospitals, I remember UCD had a very good preclinical exposure to GP land. And I remember being sent on a bus out to some flats in Crumlin with another classmate of mine interviewing a family whose child had asthma. And that the whole point was early patient contact was the name of the program. I found that from a very early stage, I was able to talk to people and relate to people on a very basic human level, irrespective of all the sciencey bit that went with medicine and all the pathology and that went with it. And I've kind of tried to use those skills the whole way through my career and find a way to converse with people and talk to people irrespective of whatever your cultural, religious or ethnic backgrounds might be, whether you're in your late 80s or you're, you know, two. I've had to talk to people the whole way through my career. You've got to find a way to be able to relate to people and communicate with people. And often you just need to hit that resonant note with people and then you're in and then you get everything that you need.
And I suppose, although, you know, the early patient contacts helped, I mean, you had a few years of preclinical stuff to get through before you could focus on that.
I did. And it was, I'm not going to lie, it was a struggle because I found it very difficult to get motivated by the likes of physics, you know, when I had such very clear aspirations about why I wanted to go into medical school to then start sitting and learning about all these different forces and laws, you know, it didn't really match with what my impression of going into medical school was going to be about.
Did anatomy eventually become an interest to you?
Ironically, no, not in the early stages. I did enough to pass, but I didn't spend my summers dissecting specimens for awards or prizes. It didn't come to me that way. The people who stood out were Patricia Fitzpatrick, who's a professor of epidemiology. She supervised me for my Bachelor of Medical Science degree. So at the time in UCD, I don't know if it still happens, you could use your preclinical grades and write a thesis and matriculate a BMed Sci degree. So I thought that that seemed to be a very good way of spending a summer. And I found it difficult to come up with an idea until I bumped into a surgeon in Wexford called Dennis Evoy. And I wanted to look at something surgical. Breast cancer screening was just coming up in Ireland at the time and just coming up in the Southeast had just come in. So I said, well, what about looking at the impact of screening on the symptomatic service? And he said, yeah, but that would be a big task because we've got Wexford, Waterford, Carlow, Kilkenny and a unit in South Tip. So you've got five units that you have to go around and there was no computer depository or repository rather of information just to mine. I had to go and trawl chart by chart. So we set it up and I did that and Prof Fitzpatrick was kind enough to supervise me and give me some really good steerage on my thesis. Yeah, I ended up coming out with a first class award for my thesis. But only a pass for my BMed Sci degree overall due to the poor grades I'd received in the preclinical.
It wasn't typical to do the BMed Sci.
No, it wasn't, but I hadn't anything else planned for the summer. And I thought that if it ever came down to an interview between me and someone else and I had it and they didn't, that might be enough to tip it. Because the areas that I was focusing on going into, basic surgical training for surgery first, then into plastics and then into trying to get cleft, they're all highly competitive areas. I remember being attached to the team in Wexford when Michael Moynihan, who played prop for UCD, Moby as he was called, was down there as an intern or an SHO. He was an SHO in surgery. And I remember saying, so like, if I'm in medical school and I really want to do surgery, what do I need to do? And he goes, look, it's really easy. All you have to do is finish in like the top 3% in your class. So I was already against an uphill battle. So things like the BMed Sci degree to me seemed like a really good idea at the time.
It sounds like you got through the preclinical years at that stage. Was it a big relief to go into the hospitals?
Massive. Like, to me, it became more of what I thought medical school was going to be. I never had a problem going around the ward, sitting at bedsides. From my time as a healthcare assistant, I had seen some really young people with severe irreversible spinal injuries coming to terms with that for the first time, you know, with fiancés, with, you know, really young children. So when you're 19, 20 and you're sitting at the bedside of someone like that, you know, a 24-year-old man who's crying his eyes out because he knows he's just been told he's never going to walk again or feel from the waist down, that matures you and you grow up very quickly when you're having those types of conversations. And you're able to bring that forward then into your clinical years and sit at the bedside of someone who's been told that they've got terminal diagnosis and there's no treatment options available for them, and have conversations with them as they, you know, start to rationalize that and come to terms with it and go through all the process that they're going to have to go through.
Where'd you do all the clerkships?
All of that was in Vincent's. I was a Vincent's UCD kind of medical student. So it was all down there with various different professors and tutors. Prof. Niall Higgins was the professor of surgery down there. I worked really hard at surgery. I didn't find it hard work. I was always hanging around theatre to see what was being done next.
Surgery was definitely your interest at that stage.
I had a very strong affinity to surgery and paediatrics as well.
Yeah, was it mostly in Crumlin for paediatrics or Temple Street?
Crumlin for paediatrics. I really loved it out there. And then when I went to GP land to do my attachment, I saw a lot of peds out there as well. And then throughout my surgical career, my plastic surgery training, I started off in Yorkshire. So I trained in Leeds Teaching Hospital, which had a big congenital hand service. Professor Simon Kay, who was the first surgeon to undertake the first UK double hand transplant, I worked for him. We had a congenital hand service there, which was very complex, and obstetrics, brachial plexus injury clinic as well. And Gráinne Burke from Ireland was one of the heads of the congenital hand service and OBPI over there as well. So I got a really good grounding in paediatrics, and we took all paediatric trauma and that as well. So paediatrics and plastics, I suppose, have kind of been hand in hand the whole way through my surgical career.
Do you remember your graduation?
I remember it more from the photographs than actually being there. My two nephews, who are now grown up adults, were there as small children. It was kind of ironic because Derek Hennessy was a classmate of mine also from Wexford. He's from Enniscorthy. Both his family and our family shared something in common, that both our fathers were deceased. His had died also when he was in his teens. And we kind of went out for dinner together as two mothers with their two sons who just graduated without a father to kind of share the experience with.
And then your internship?
Internship was Loughlinstown. I didn't make the cut for Vincent's, which in hindsight I was really grateful for, because my intern year really cemented my love of surgery and it kickstarted my CV to kind of help me on my way towards a career in surgery. I started with surgery for the first 6 months, and Gary Brough was the surgeon there at the time. Declan McGee, Stephen Sheehan, Justin Gagan, they were all the consultant surgeons there, and they were very supportive of me, even though I was only a lowly intern at the time. I was always down looking for things to get my hands involved with doing stuff. I also studied during my intern year when I was in on so many nights. So I did my MRCS part one and two whilst I was an intern. I also had a logbook, so I took the minor ops list as an intern because I'd done my basic surgical skills course in Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh. And I knew how to cut and I knew how to stitch. So I did that list, and I had a logbook then to discuss when I went into my BST interview, which other people hadn't had.
Was that the first time you actually found out whether you had the dexterity to do it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people nowadays are talking about manual dexterity, computer games, and being able to use that as a surrogate marker of ability. And even now, when I'm talking to people about getting ready for, you know, core surgical training interviews or applications, they're talking about how they have to do 3D spatial visualization tests and things like that. None of that existed. But I did have manual dexterity because I used to build things when I was a kid.
And, without breaching anyone's confidentiality, I mean, you must have, are there people you've seen over the years who found out they couldn't do it when they actually got that far?
Yeah, because I think nowadays it's very hard to pick people up at a very early stage and say, this isn't the career for you. To take someone aside and go, look, I really admire you as a person, but I don't think your skill set matches the job description here is very difficult. I've also found that people who are going through medical school, who were, say, a lot more academic than I was in the first 3 years, they're getting through and getting high scores and becoming very advanced very quickly before someone actually takes notice and go, but you don't have a logbook compared to your peers, because they're hiding from certain aspects of the job. And things are so busy and the number of people are so few and the firm system is dropping a lot more that we find it very difficult to keep tabs on all the trainees that are under our service rather than on our team anymore. Yeah. I mean, I was a basic surgical trainee under Ken Mealy in Wexford, and he knew exactly where I was, what I could do, what I couldn't do, where my strengths and weaknesses lay. Because when we did clinic with Ken Mealy, there was a diary. And if you saw a patient and you wanted to add them to the list for an operation, you'd go and you'd talk to Mr. Mealy, who'd come and examine the patient, agree with you or disagree. But if he agreed, say, yeah, Mr. Murphy needs a hernia repair, an umbilical hernia repair, put him in the diary. You had to put your name beside it. And in Wexford, he had devised a list of registrar operations and SHO operations. And hernia repair was an SHO operation. So if I booked Mr. Murphy for a hernia repair and put my name beside it, when his secretary made the theatre list, my name was in brackets beside it, meaning I had to do that operation. Yeah. So when Mr. Murphy was in the anaesthetic room, I had to stand in the theatre tea room in front of Mr. Mealy, and I had to, on my 6x4 cards, be able to relay the steps of a hernia operation from Kirk's textbook in general surgery, yeah, starting with how I wanted the patient to be positioned, how I wanted them to be prepped and draped, whether I was going to use antibiotics or not, and why and what the rationale was for it, what the first incision was going to be, how I was going to orientate it, what size blade I wanted to use, how I was going to stop the bleeding, what the next layer of tissue was going to be. That stepwise approach, I had to tell him every step of the operation. And if I knew it well enough, he would let me do it and he would scrub and assist me. He also taught us all how to get central venous access blindly using landmarks. So we were putting in subclavian lines under GA on patients because he thought it was a skill every surgeon needed to be able to do if you came across someone in the field or in an operating theatre who was hemorrhaging badly and you needed to get that access quickly.
Yeah. And where'd you move on to from there?
From Wexford, I went to orthopaedics in Waterford, got on very well down there. I found, you know, it was, again, very strict. There was huge volumes of trauma coming through that service. So you had to be on top of your game. When we were on call, we accepted patients from all over the southeast. The post-take board round was basically me in front of a light box with everyone's x-rays, their history known off and in my head, as well as being able to describe the classification on the x-rays as an SHO. And it started off that they would contradict me and say I got the classification wrong. But then when I kept doing it, then they started to teach me the classifications. Then they started to let me put some screws in. Then they started letting me do simple RFs on my own with the registrar scrubbed. And then it got to a stage that we'd be presenting the board round cases before I left there. And there would be no interruptions because I was getting everything right. So I was operating at the level of a junior reg in orthopedics because I showed up and they matched whatever I invested in terms of their time and input and teaching. And it generated a really good outcome for everyone.
And had you finished all your exams at this stage?
Well, I'd done the MRCS before I even started. But then I went on from there and I got my first plastics job in James's. And that went very well. And from there to vascular in James's. And I was on the general on-call, surgical on-call rota in James's.
How'd you move it on from there?
There used to be a scheme then called the residency program in plastic surgery. It doesn't exist now. It was a 2-year scheme of a year as a senior SHO and a year as a junior reg. And it was basically to allow people who wanted to pursue plastic surgery to get some level of experience because there was no run-through training. People weren't coming from their second SHO year and then into a number job. You usually had to do the rounds and prove your ability and that and your dedication beforehand. But everyone had to do a higher degree. And I was looking for loads of ways of trying to avoid the academic component of this. I'm going back to my pre-clinical years and lab-based work and study and theory and all of that was really going to, I knew I was not going to enjoy it as much as I did the hands-on day-to-day running of a surgical job. And a girlfriend had appeared at the time when I was in Galway who I thought there might be more to this. So I didn't really want to go off to the academic lab I had lined up in Toronto because she couldn't get a job there. So instead I went to Perth in between the senior SHO year and the junior clinical year of the residency program to do lab-based research with Professor Fiona Wood. And that was the first time I'd A, been to Australia, B, been away from home for any period of time on my own. You kind of learn a lot about yourself when you're on your own, you know. I knew I loved rugby. I knew I loved being a doctor. I was over there and I thought, well, why don't I see what happens in the Western Force? Because at this stage, I'd done immediate medical management on the field of play with Leeds Rhinos. I'd kind of started to explore sports side of being a doctor at the same time. And Mike Cadigan was the Wallabies team doctor at the time. He was an ED consultant in Charles Gardner in Perth, and he was the Western Force doctor. So for the crack, I went back through PubMed, found that he'd published, and often the principal author has to include their correspondence. So I had his email address from a paper he'd written 10 years previously. So I tossed a coin and sent him an email. And I got an email back about 2 weeks later from one of the assistant doctors in Western Force and said, are you serious? Can I give you a call? So I spoke with him on the phone. And the next thing I know, I'm being picked up by Mike Cadigan outside UWBA to be brought to the stadium for a home game. So I was pitch side with the Western Force. And that really opened my eyes to how they had structured the medical support for professional rugby teams. They had more doctors there than I'd seen at some reunions. They had a doctor for airway. They had a doctor for each team. They had a doctor in the stand. They had a suture doctor for both teams so that the team doc didn't have to go in and stitch someone. There was two doctors who were literally, their job was just to walk around the stadium and that if there was something went wrong with the crowd, there was someone who could be there as a first responder. The structure of it was phenomenal. So I was really keen to kind of see that. And I went to a few games and at one point in Australia, myself and my girlfriend who'd come out now, we had to make a decision. Do we stay here or do we go home? My girlfriend had been a dentist before she was a doctor, so she was doubly qualified. She was really keen to pursue MaxFacs and they offered her maxillofacial training in Perth straight off the bat, straight onto a training scheme. As we were getting the visa process underway, my wife had a phone call home and she just decided she really missed home and wanted to go. So we packed our bags and back we went. But we didn't go back to Ireland and I didn't go back to the residency program because there was no MaxFacs training in Ireland at the time, either north or south of the border. So we ended up having to go to the UK so that my wife could pursue MaxFacs. I did an interview with Leeds. I started work as an SHO, but I found there was a significant difference between what I was able to do from my time as an SHO, an intern in Loughlinstown taking over the minors list, my experience of basic surgical training in Wexford, Waterford and James's, and then my experience as a senior SHO in Galway put me in a position far different to even their junior registrars. So I was doing more, leading more, explaining more, teaching more, and I was teaching their junior regs even though I was in an SHO position. So I applied for a training number and I got shortlisted for interview. And at the time over there, based on your application, they rank everybody based on your application on how it scored. So I was in 64th position and there were 9 numbers available. I remember that the letter that came congratulating me on my interview slot told me to make sure I brought my portfolio, but I didn't know what a portfolio was. So I had to go to a consultant who didn't know me because I'd only started 2 weeks previously and ask him, would he give me some interview practice? And he said, sure, bring your portfolio. I didn't have one. I didn't know what it was. I went to WH Smith, which is like the UK version of Easton's, and I bought a fake leather. You know, if you go to like a Spanish restaurant and they give you a massive wine list in a big leather bound book with all the plastic sleeves inside. Yeah. I had one of them, but I literally just put everything I had done, my CV at the front, front slides of all the presentations I delivered, you know, research I'd written, all the courses I'd done, things like that. And that's what I brought in. But I stood in the foyer of the Royal College of Surgeons in London, getting ready to be interviewed. And I saw people coming in with wheeling trolleys. And I was like, my girlfriend was sat beside me. And I said, Molly, what are they? And then she kind of went over to listen to them. And they were their PhDs that they had written. I hadn't even written up my master's at this stage. I wanted to go. I was like, there is no point. I'm in 64th position. These guys have PhDs, three-piece suits from Savile Row. There is zero chance of this happening. And she convinced me not to go and to stay. She goes, look, it's an hour max. You'll be done. We'll go and have a bit of lunch and we'll back up in Leeds in no time. We can think of a plan B from there. But you will never be good at the next interview unless you experience the hell of this one. Yeah. I was like, right, that sounds like sound advice. I'll put myself through hell. And I went in and it was all very clinically orientated. All largely clinical scenarios. There was a little vignette. There was a piece of paper in front of the guy who was interviewing me and he was reading out a story and there were two pictures in front of me of what was a classic electrical burn with an entry wound, an exit wound, a catheterized patient with myoglobin urea, which is the kidneys have given up, myoglobin's in the bag from all the muscle damage. And it was just so barn door because I had seen this in James's time and time again. I'd been on the front line. I'd admitted these patients. I'd done everything. I'd put them on telemetry. I'd discussed everything else that needed to be done, whether to give bicarbonate or not. All of that I had done with the regs over the phone in James's. So when he was struggling to find the vignette that read out the little short history of what had happened, I said, oh, let me guess, he was walking back from a building site and he grabbed an electrical cable. And the guy said, have you been talking to people outside? I said, no, but that's a classic entry point. That's a classic exit wound. This guy's got myoglobin urea. Yeah. And I went through all the blurb. And then he started me with another scenario. And it was another one I'd seen before. And then it was another scenario. And then the phone call to the consultant was one I'd made previously because I'd been around and I'd done everything. I hadn't done a run-through scheme. I had done my time as an SHO, as a supplemental SHO. And I knew how to talk to people. I knew how to summarize information. I knew how to present a history over the phone to a registrar or a consultant. And I went from 64th position to 6th. And I got my number in Leeds. So thanks to my now wife, which she still reminds me of every time, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her.
So when did that action then? You moved on to the scheme immediately?
So I interviewed in April and I started on the scheme in the August. So I was literally an SHO in the UK for only a matter of months before moving on and going through my training. And I did my training there in Leeds General Infirmary and Bradford for about 3.5-4 years. My wife at this stage, we got married. We were pregnant with our first child and it was sort of an epiphany moment. She didn't want to be in a two-surgeon household. So she wanted to switch from MaxFax. She was working as a MaxFax reg in Leeds General Infirmary. She wanted to switch and she chose radiology. So she became a radiology trainee and was offered a number either in Leeds or in Belfast. And because she's from Northern Ireland, she was really keen to go to Belfast. So she moved home with our daughter when my daughter was 6 months and I was battling then for an interdeanery transfer in the UK system, which was very difficult. But I did and I got into Belfast and I used that then as a springboard to undertake more fellowships. So I did all my fellowships pre-CCT. So my training just kept getting extended. Yeah. So at the end of it, I was a trainee for 8 years. I did my normal basic plastics training for 6 years. And then I went to Adelaide in Australia with my wife and daughter. And I did a craniofacial fellowship with Professor David David, who was one of Tessier's disciples. And then he was teaching me and I was his penultimate fellow in the Australian craniofacial unit in Adelaide, which was renowned at the time. When I got accepted for the fellowship, I applied for the UK and Ireland Roenick Scholarship, which is an Australasian scholarship. And I was awarded it. So they funded my flights over and I had a bursary to use. So I used that bursary to part fund Masters in Advanced Surgery and Craniofacial Surgery through Macquarie University when I was there. And I won the Macquarie European Scholarship to also make up the shortfall in funding when I was there. So I got that degree for free based on two scholarships. And then because I had won two international scholarships, I applied for a trainee award back in the Northern Ireland Deanery. So I was awarded their trainee of the year based on the fact that I'd won two international scholarships that year. So I came out with three awards, a degree and a very successful fellowship that teed me up to get into my Clef fellowship in Scotland.
Okay, so that's where you moved next?
Yeah. What we didn't factor in was when we were flying home from Adelaide, we didn't realise it at the time, but we were pregnant with twins. We'd had a miscarriage in Australia, which was very difficult, and we were quite remote from family. So that was a very difficult time when we were both being fellows. But we were pregnant again on the plane without knowing it with twins. So I came back and did some time in Belfast, in the Burns unit in Belfast, and then off we went to Glasgow. The twins were premature. We had a bit of a hairy experience with them towards the very end of the third trimester. But thankfully, everything went okay and we ended up with two healthy babies. But we were on the boat to Glasgow, to Scotland, when they hadn't even reached their estimated date of delivery. So we were in Scotland with no family backup, three children under the age of four and one income. So it was difficult. And in order to make ends meet, I also worked in the Max Fax on-call rota, as well as the Plastics on-call rota, as well as the Clef TIG, to try and get enough income to sustain us all over there.
So that was one of your hardest times, I suppose, was it?
That was probably one of the most difficult times on a personal level. Professionally, it was brilliant. The fellowship itself was phenomenal. The structure of it and how I got to go in there as someone who'd never operated on a three-month-old baby, doing lip repairs solo, to being someone who was running the entire service for the consultants when I left to show that I was ready, was just transformative. It was a testament to the three trainers I had in Cleft in Scotland, or one from a plastics background, two from a Max Fax background, just the professionalism and their availability. They were just really genuinely good human beings who love teaching their craft. And I was very receptive to it and flourished in that type of environment.
And then I suppose that at some stage then the pressure came on to move elsewhere.
Well, I had chosen Scotland because I knew they were down at the time that I had applied, they were down to two surgeons and I knew they needed a third. And one surgeon had retired. So I had hoped that if I proved myself in the first 6 months, they would hold the job open for me and allow me to apply. But within 4 weeks of landing, they had advertised the job and the successful applicant was in post to help teach me. So Scotland was out of the question. And then Swansea came up. So I interviewed for the job in Wales, got it. And I had four extremely happy, successful years there as a Clef surgeon. Before we made the decision to come back to Ireland, which unfortunately has cost me my Clef career.
I mean, it's a trade-off, but I suppose, you know, you're in a different area now.
Yeah, now I'm working in Dublin. The family home is based north of the border in Newry. So there's some days I commute up and down, and then depending on the workload, I can stay down if need be, and I stay down for on-call. I've taken over Professor Sean Carroll's practice, which has involved quite a lot of work with pressure-injured, spinal-injured patients, people who need attention and care and an MDT. And I found that the problem was that a lot of the time when they were coming in to see Prof. Carroll, they were seeing him as the plastics consultant, but it wasn't very easy to get that MDT discussion going with the nutritionist, with the OT who's used to dealing with spinal-injured patients who can make cushions to adapt, with the rehab consultant and all the rest. So what we've now done, and in the 2 years that I've been here, is we've engineered a post in the National Rehab Hospital where I've come to you from this morning. So I now go to the patients rather than them coming to me. So they don't have to suffer the indignity of being laid up on ambulance trolley waiting to be seen in the one room that can accommodate a hoist, for example, in the outpatients in Vincent's. Instead, I see them in their own environment, in their own rooms. We've got our own tissue viability nurse just for pressure injured patients. We've got the rehab consultants there, the OTs, the dietitians, the full gambit. So we're really structuring a service now along the lines of what I would have been used to in Clef care to try and maximise results and outcomes for these patients who are just as deserving as anyone else.
And I suppose, you're making a lot of your new position and it's obviously successful already.
Yeah, I've had some huge success stories, really complex wounds, chronic wounds that have been going on for years, just real aggressive debridement, sometimes with the help of my orthopedic colleagues, disarticulating, osteomyelitic hips and resecting all of that infected bone, getting back to real clean, healthy tissue and just employing really simple reconstructive techniques, but meticulous wound care and a proper MDT approach to see patients drive themselves out of the NRH, you know, within a number of months. That's been like the most rewarding element of this new aspect of my job, which goes some way to replacing the type of rewards I used to get from handing a 3-month-old baby back to their parents after, you know, a bilateral cleft lip repair.
And obviously with your split locations, is it a bit difficult to maintain a bit of work-life balance? Or
I wouldn't say so, because the one thing that the new consultant contract has afforded us here is time. So I don't have a private practice, and that gives me time. And the 37-hour week, I'm condensing it as much as possible. I work between Michael's and Dunleary, the National Rehab Hospital, and Vincent's. And I do as much work as I can on the days when I'm on call. So I front end my week quite heavily when my wife's week is a little bit lighter. I get to do an awful lot more stuff than I was doing anywhere else throughout my training, both for my kids and also for me. Since I stopped playing rugby in UCD and in Australia, I played in Perth when I was over there with Cottesloe Blues. That leaves a huge chasm, and it's very difficult when you've been used to doing something in a very structured team environment in your 40s to find something to fill that void, because the problem is you still eat like you're 25, training twice a week in the gym and training, you know, having a match on a Saturday. And then all of a sudden you've got that mid-40s dad physique that you kind of swore in your 20s you would never have. So I've kind of found various things like running. I never thought I'd be able to run if it wasn't chasing a ball around a pitch, but I do a bit of that now. And even at 100 kilos, I can run 5K in under 25 minutes, which I'm pretty proud of. And I've signed up for a high rocks with my cousin in Poznan at the end of this year. So I've got something to target and something to aim for. So work-life balance is absolutely much better than it has been throughout my training. But I think I convinced myself as a trainee that those really difficult, hard working years were so I could have that as a consultant. So once I've come to this stage in my career, I'm just determined to make sure that I do eke that out and that I didn't sacrifice a lot of things in my younger years doing research papers and audits and everything I had to do once the job was done and I went home, that I didn't want to make sure I sacrificed that for then nothing when I get to this stage. So, between the kids and those other few hobbies that I have, I'm kept very busy. I have a daughter who's a very keen horse rider and wants to be a show jumper. So bringing her to her activity is a 2.5-hour round trip between catching a pony, loading a pony, towing it to the arena where she's being coached, and then back again. You know, it's a full-time job in itself.
With all that in mind, as we're drawing to a close, do you think in terms of having a legacy or what something you want to be remembered for?
I'd like people who I've trained, I suppose, to remember that one of the things I left them with was that before we're surgeons and before we have ego and before we're anything else, we have to be human. And if you can bring that into your communication, and if you can be human to the patients that are under your care, I think you've won 90% of the battle. The other thing I'd love trainees to remember from me would be that it's okay to say, I don't know. If a patient comes in with a lump or a bump and I'm flummoxed by it, I tell them in front of the trainees, I'm not sure what this is, but my gut's either making me worried or not, and I want to investigate it further. You know, so saying I don't know is okay to do, but you can't leave it at that. You have to go then and empty the tank to find out. But once you're able to give patients that assurance, and I think once you're able to communicate with people as a human being without an ego, then I think, you know, you've won half the battle. So if anything, that would be it. On a more clinical, professional level, I don't know the answer to the question yet, but I would hope that my management of babies with cleft palate and Raban sequence in Wales proves fruitful. I had just a gut instinct that the reason why babies who were born with the Raban sequence and cleft palate were doing worse in terms of speech outcome was because their surgery was so delayed because of their airway concerns. And I brought this kind of theory to the paediatric respiratory team in Cardiff when I was there. And Prof. Iolo Dool gave me an ear and discussed it with his own colleagues. And we came up with a pathway whereby we could protect the airway for babies with Raban sequence, but operate on them in the same time frame as we did with kids without Raban sequence. So they had nasopharyngeal airways, they had pulse oximeters at home, we had a pediatric nurse, respiratory specialist nurse on call for them. We had all parents trained in CPR, neonatal CPR before leaving the hospital. We had sleep studies at birth, at 6 weeks and at 6 months. And if the sleep study at 6 months looked good, we scheduled them for surgery at 9 months, and they had a sleep study right beforehand and about 6 weeks after surgery. And we got all our Raban sequence babies on the normal cleft palate protocol, whereas other centres were doing it 12, 13 months of age when we knew that the speech outcomes were significantly impaired. But unfortunately, in cleft surgery, it takes a good 6.5 years from the time that the babies are born before you know what your outcomes are. So we'll have to wait another couple of years. My lead speech therapist did a preliminary assessment at 3 years of age instead of the formal auditable 5 year of age assessment, and said that there was no difference between the Raban sequence babies and the normal cleft babies. So 85% of them were coming back with normal speech. So if that comes to be true, that will be phenomenal, and I'd love to be remembered for that. But I think teaching trainees to be human, first of all, and trying to dispel a lot of the ego that goes with surgery would be one thing that I would hope that a lot of them would take.
Well, that sounds like great advice, and it's been a very interesting hearing about your life and your career. I'm sure everyone's going to find this fascinating. I look forward to hearing about your next chapter. Thank you very much for coming in.
No problem. Pleasure.